Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be taking up a topic that we have certainly discussed before on this program, and that is reform of the healthcare system here in the United States. Here in this country, we pay almost twice as much for healthcare as do other industrialized nations, and you would think, having spent all of that money, we should have the best healthcare system in the world. Clearly, we do not. We know that there is widespread dissatisfaction among physicians and their patients about how healthcare in this country is delivered. And also, there is the growing problem of the uninsured. Right now, it's something like 45 million Americans that don't have health insurance. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about healthcare in the United States, how we got to the place that we are, and perhaps what we might do to address some of these concerns. And we have, as our guests, two gentlemen who have been thinking about these issues for a long time and have both had long careers in both government and in academe. Our guests for the program are Julius Richmond and Rashi Fine. Dr. Julius Richmond is a physician. He is a founder of Head Start. He served as Surgeon General under the in the Carter administration. He currently is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Health Policy Emeritus at Harvard University. Rashi Fine is Professor of Medical Economics Emeritus, also at Harvard University. He was in the Kennedy administration. He served on the staff of President Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors, and then in the 1970s started to become involved with Senator Edward Kennedy and the Committee for National Health Insurance. Together, they have authored a book titled The Healthcare Mess, How We Got Into It and What It Will Take to Get Out. And it's published by the Harvard University Press. The book is available, I'm sure, in bookstores if people who are listening would like to read it. Questions and comments are also welcome here on the program from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that callers are brief as possible, so that way we can get in as many callers, as many people who would like to participate and keep the program moving along. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. And then anywhere else you might hear us around Illinois, Indiana, actually even if people are listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. And that is 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Richmond, hello.
Yes.
And Dr. Fine.
How do you do?
Thank you both very much for being with us. I'll try hard to see if I can associate your names with your voices so I can tell who I'm talking to at any particular point. And again, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. The story is complicated. And we are talking here, you review what has gone on in healthcare over approximately a century now, going back to 1900, and dividing this into basically three eras, from 1900 to the mid-60s, from the mid-60s to the mid-80s, from the mid-80s to the place that we are now, looking a little bit at how the practice of medicine has changed and how the delivery of medical services has changed. Why don't we start, and perhaps we can talk a little bit. I'll give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about what happened and what's the important thing to know about each of these periods. Perhaps just starting with acknowledging how much medical technology changed, particularly, I guess, the pace of change would have been very rapid in the post-war period, where we had started to have various kinds of treatments and technologies that previously physicians just didn't have.
Yes, I think, David, you're touching on a very important point, and I think while we are concerned about the inequities in the delivery system, on the development of biotechnologies, we have a very rich history, and we're the envy of the world in that context. And in our book, we suggest that this is in part because the academic medical community partnered with government following World War II in the biological revolution that was occurring then. And in that partnership, we established the National Institutes of Health, which, of course, is a federal grant-giving institution, and it has in turn supported our universities and university-based research. And it's out of that partnership that we've had these remarkable developments in biomedical research, and as a consequence, the technologies which have transformed medical practice.
And I think there that this raises in my mind that one of the changes that you certainly write about in the book is that over time we have the delivery of healthcare has passed increasingly to the private sector. Although the government still is involved in many ways, paying for the healthcare for certain people, and there are still, of course, very large research bodies that are funded by the federal government to do that kind of research. But I guess in my mind, it raises the question of what exactly is the role, what should be the role for the federal government in promoting healthcare and delivering healthcare and promoting research. It seems that that's a question that we seem not to have a very solid grasp on now.
Well, this is Rashi Fine, and let me take a stab at it. The advances in medical science and in medical technology, in fact, of course, made medical care that much more valuable, albeit it didn't make it more accessible. As a matter of fact, if anything, it increased the costs of medical care and made it for major parts of the population less accessible. You use two words in your question, what is and what should be, and of course they're very different.
Yeah.
What is the role of the federal government in the funding of health care? Largely, you know, excluding the VA and the Defense Department, which should not be excluded. They're very important. But the thing that most of us intersect with or know about are Medicare and Medicaid. And so the federal government is underwriting through Medicare and Medicaid something in the order of over $500 billion a year. What should the role be is, it seems to both of us, is not to stop with Medicare, people over age 65 or the disabled, not to stop with Medicaid, which is not a program, though most people think of it as a program for the poor, but only for certain poor, as we are learning today with the individuals who left New Orleans and other places as a result of Katrina and now are having great difficulty in obtaining medical care, though they are destitute. One should think, of expanding the role of the federal government to make certain that every American have health insurance, which does not mean that every American gets delivery of health care via a VA or a Defense Department model. The private sector delivers the medical care under Medicare and under Medicaid, and there is a role for that private sector. But that private sector is not able to fund the medical care for the 45 million uninsured and the many, many million who are temporarily uninsured or are so close to being uninsured because their benefits are so limited that effectively, though we don't count them, they are really uninsured. So the role is a large one today. The role should be, on the funding side, much larger, would be, I think, our answer to the two-part question.
Yeah. I'm sure that you would say, and others would agree, that the creation of Medicare and Medicaid was a very significant event in that we, as a society, we said, we're going to begin here by identifying at least these two groups of individuals, that is, seniors and some, as you say, some, not all, but some poor people, and say that even if these people can't provide for their own health care, we're going to, as a society, we're going to do that. That though the question then becomes, why is it we stop there? Why was the idea at one time that this would be the place that we would start and that we would go beyond that? Or even at the time that they were created, was the idea that there were special populations of people and that we were going to see that their health care needs were met, but that past that, everybody else was on their own?
Well, you're talking about the period of 1965, when we had the political will in this country, during the course of the Civil Rights Revolution and the War on Poverty, to pass these two very major pieces of legislation, Medicare and Medicaid. I think it is important to differentiate the two, because Medicare is, of course, a national program for all people over 65, and it has a certain kind of simplicity. Because of the opposition of the organized medical profession at that time, we didn't enact a similar program for the poor. Rather, under Medicaid, we essentially have 50 different programs. The federal government partners with the states, but as a consequence, you have wide variation in the funding and the accessibility and the populations served. So our great thrust in the book is that in an affluent society like ours, we have the resources, we believe, to really create equity in the healthcare system so that all people have an entitlement to healthcare. Now, that doesn't really mean that they all would have immediate access to healthcare, because there are rural areas and inner city areas where we don't have the providers that we ought to be having. So you've raised a very important question in how we deal with moving toward equity.
I think it's worth remembering that Medicare, when it was enacted, was seen as a building block, the first step. And indeed, a few years after Medicare's enactment and implementation, Medicaid, I should add, was seen as a stopgap measure. A few years after Medicare's enactment and implementation, Senator Kennedy and Martha Griffiths introduced their national health insurance program. In the early 70s, President Nixon introduced a program called CHIP, Comprehensive Health Insurance Program. The journal magazine Medical Economics surveyed, quote, 100 experts in the early 70s, and almost unanimously, 94% of them were convinced that we would have universal health insurance within 6 years. That building block remains, but it was not extended. And not only did that mean that we ran into problems of the 45 million Americans who don't have insurance, but we ran into problems with Medicare itself, because Medicare is embodied in a healthcare system that is dysfunctional. And so Medicare has turned out to be a very valuable program, but a program which is not as strong today as it was on July 1st, 1966, when it first went into play. Mm.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest. We have a caller we'll get to. We're talking this morning with Dr. Julius Richmond. He is a physician. He is professor of health policy emeritus at Harvard University. Also talking this morning with Rashi Fine. He is professor of medical economics emeritus at Harvard Med School. Together, they have authored a book titled The Healthcare Mess, How We Got Into It and What It Will Take to Get Out. And it's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line and good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Belgium nearby, and that's on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Nice to hear you back. I have a point about this. As a young man, I noticed that doctors were put on a pillar, and they were pretty much next to God. And now that I've gotten older, I question people, the healthcare thing about why can't we have systems pretty much like Canada or Europe, places like that, where most people are insured. And you hit a roadblock when you come up against nurses and doctors and healthcare providers, and they all say, oh, we don't want to go there because the quality of the care there is so poor, and it takes forever to get in. Then I go talk to Canadians, and they say, well, we have a good health care system. We get plenty of stuff, and we do just fine. And isn't part of the disconnect with our health care system really some of these old ideas that physicians are pretty much godly and what they say is right?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and I think we often encounter the situation where people are very dissatisfied with the system as a whole, but have great confidence and affection for their individual physician. So you have that kind of dichotomy. And I think that all of the bureaucratization that has taken place in the healthcare system with the proliferation of third-party payers, which is how most of the more affluent population now pay for their health care, has really made it very complex and created a certain amount of unhappiness among the provider population, the physicians and nurses that you talk about. So you've introduced a very complicated and very interesting kind of sociologic change that's taken place.
I think I'd add that we have a line in the book, quoting Bob Dylan, the times, they are a-changin'. And I think that line applies to the attitudes and the views of many, many physicians and certainly many, many nurses. I don't think that they are the obstacle to progress at this time. I think the obstacle to progress resides, if you will, in two chambers and one house in Washington, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House. And the reason that it resides there and elsewhere in state legislatures is that we have become, our representatives are convinced that they cannot have a intellectual, rational discussion with the American public about what our taxes go for and would we or would we not be willing to reorganize a medical care system so that we would pay less in premiums and more in taxes. And they appeal to our worst instincts. Our best instincts come out then at moments of crisis, as we have seen in Texas and in areas close to New Orleans. But our worst symptoms seem to rule the day.
The point I'm really getting at more than anything else, sirs, is the fact that the people who receive this care in other systems like Canada and Europe seem to be completely happy with it, and there's such a total disconnect with what we understand they have and what we have. I mean,
I think you're absolutely right. Let me give you an illustration. 2 days ago, I broke a tooth. Yesterday, I saw the dentist, and he was able to tell me, I can get you in for a root canal 1 week from today. And that required my changing my appointment with my ophthalmologist. I gave the tooth a higher priority. I spent an hour on the phone on hold, listening to good music, with the ophthalmologist secretary this morning, and the appointment of October 12th was changed to the first available appointment, November 30th. If I wrote that story about Canada, Americans would nod their head. Yeah, that's what happens up there. We don't nod our head when it happens to us.
Exactly.
There is a disconnect.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and I would just reinforce your point because there are a lot of data to validate it, and that is that all of the other developed countries have universal access, the financing of universal access, and their health records are better than ours by and large. So there's a mythology that has grown up in this country that our health care is the best in the world, but that really isn't borne out by the vital statistics.
And that's where I'm saying that our physicians and our insurance providers and everything want to keep us thinking that we've got the best system, the yet our system has failed us miserably in every direction.
That's why we wrote the book, and that's why others have written similar books, an attempt to tell the story, at least as we and as others see it. I can't help but pick up on that point. What has happened? If you take the Clinton plan, which failed to even be introduced in Congress in 1993, you will recall that it was the insurance industry that financed the public relations campaign that largely defeated the bill. The insurance industry, you may recall, ran the Harry and Louise ads, you know, that government can't do anything right, and you can't trust government, and undermining our confidence, and ultimately that, it seems to me, leads to some of the failures of government that that we have seen with Katrina and other national disasters.
Interesting aspect about this is that we give up our health care for our money. You know what I mean? We don't want to spend it, and the doctors don't want to keep from getting it, or the insurance companies, or the nurses, or the pharmacists, or whatever way you want to continue to look at. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. Well, just let's for a moment, and I have some other calls here, and I promise these people I won't keep them on hold forever. But I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the health insurance industry, because this is certainly, again, if you look at this period we're talking about, particularly, I guess, even just since the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, it's an industry that has grown tremendously. It existed, but not in its present form back at that time. So now it is an enormous industry, and as you point out, has very significant political clout. How did we end up with the health insurance industry being so big and so powerful?
When Medicare was enacted, the health insurance industry was able to perform a function that needed to be performed, and was perfectly willing to view themselves as having a limited role, but a very, very lucrative one. Namely, they processed pieces of paper. All of those listeners who are on Medicare know that they receive statements that say this is not a bill. That statement does not come from National Medicare headquarters. That statement is coming from private firms that have a contract with Medicare to process claims and to send you that this is not a bill letter. Many insurers were very, very willing to continue that kind of a relationship where they got their 8-12% for doing that job. Medicare could probably have done it, could certainly have done it at less expense, but we have preferred the private sector, even if when it is less efficient than government. And then came the development of the model of HMOs, health maintenance organizations, and these needed funding. There was therefore a federal loan program that would provide funding and federal approval. But the Wall Street financiers, acting through insurance companies in many cases, saw an even better opportunity, because if you took out a loan from the federal government, you had to pay that loan back, and that limited the amount of capital that would flow in. But if you sold stock, then the debt servicing aspects were simply not there. And so the insurance companies decided that they were not just going to process pieces of paper, they were going to organize the delivery system. And what you have now are large insurers that have...
Dr. Richman, Dr. Fine, I think that we have lost the guest. Well, occasionally that happens. We'll get the call set up again. And as it is about the midpoint, why don't I take the opportunity to reintroduce the guests, as I try to do periodically, so people will know who that they're listening to. We're talking in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Julius Richmond. He is a physician, MD, and Dr. Rashi Fine. He is a PhD doctor. Julius Richmond is a founder, also was the first director of Head Start, and served as Surgeon General during the Carter administration. He currently is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Health Policy Emeritus at Harvard University. Also with us is Dr. Rashi Fine. He's professor of medical economics emeritus at Harvard Med School. He also has served in government. He was on the staff of President Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors, also in the 1970s, began his involvement with Senator Edward Kennedy and the Committee for National Health Insurance. And together, they have authored a book that explores this territory that we are exploring here this morning. Their book is titled The Healthcare Mess, How We Got Into It, and What It Will Take to Get Out, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. And here we have the guest once again. Somehow we lost you there for a moment. I think it was Dr. Richmond who was speaking last.
It was
Dr. Fine. My apologies.
Let me just quickly conclude so that we can turn to the caller.
Yes.
And so we have the development of insurance companies who now have organized a delivery system, who are related to large numbers of physicians. And in many ways, we have created, if you will, a mess in which the insurer is also the deliverer of care. And if you want to talk about potential conflicts of interest, they are there. As the insurer wants to keep premiums down and uses various devices to tell physicians what to do and what not to do.
All right. Well, let us talk with some other callers, and we have a number of them. In fact, the lines are full. Starting out here, we'll just take them in the order they came in, starting out with someone in Champaign first, line one.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We started with two facts. One was that the percentage of our GDP that's spent on medical care is a lot larger in the U.S. than in any other country. Secondly, that we don't have as good a healthcare system as some other countries. So I guess my question is, two questions. One is, who are those other countries that have better systems than the United States? And it would seem to me that the appropriate research would be, where are they spending money where we are not, and where are we spending money where they are not? Because those two facts seem to indicate an inefficiency in our system. So I'd like the guest to say, where are we inefficient in medical system, and where are they more efficient?
One place, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague, one place that leaps to mind very quickly because it's big, is that if you will recall, what we call spending on medical care is not just the physician intersecting with the patient or the nurse or the hospital. It is also the administrative costs of the healthcare sector. And our administrative costs don't rival at all. They are multiples of any other country, in part because we made a decision, willy-nilly, if you will, but reflecting a set of social values that we really believe in the marketplace and in competition, even in this sector. And the consequence is that we have multiple insurance companies, each one advertising, many pieces of paper being processed. Your average physician and his receptionist or her receptionist intersecting with dozens of insurers, each providing dozens of policies, so that our burden of non-medical but administrative expenses is 2 to 3 times as much as that of Canada, with a essentially single-payer system, of France, of Germany, which use, by the way, employer-based systems, of Great Britain, which uses a single payer, if you will, in that government covers the entire insurance. So that's one big area, but Julie will take it further.
Yes. Well, I think your point about what do they do better
by universal access, of course, people have access to preventive services much more readily, and that always helps to keep costs down. And I would just add that in our country, the more affluent population that has both the financing for accessing services and who knows their way around the system, you know, really get high quality care. But it's essentially those who don't have the financing, in other words, the uninsured and the partially insured, that have great difficulty in accessing the system. And so they often use very high-cost services like emergency rooms as one example.
So so under your system, would you is there some kind of change that you would make in the technology of providing healthcare, because the administrative costs don't come anywhere close to explaining the large percentage difference in GDP that we spend. So, I mean, is there something like we'll spend less on extending people's lives and more on preventive healthcare or things like that that are really the technology of medical care?
Well, we would spend more on preventive care. There are data that would substantiate that the lack of preventive care leads low-income individuals to get medical care in the hospital, because hospitals are required to do that, but to spend longer in the hospital when they are ill, because they come in later in the development of the disease, the illness, or the condition. So that shift would make a substantial difference. It is important that every universal health insurance program that has been proposed, Kennedy, Nixon, Clinton, and those that didn't have such distinguished auspices, has estimated that covering the United States population in its entirety would, in the first few years, cost 5% more than we are now spending, and that then there would be a crossover point where we would spend less than we would now, than we would be spending if we kept the current system. And I think it's largely the administrative costs, the preventive care. It is not tackling the very important issue that you raise about extending life and so on. Undoubtedly, that's a problem that would have to be addressed over time. But we're taking a step at a time.
And so my understanding was that these other countries spend far less in extending life than we do in the United States.
I don't know whether that is or isn't the case.
Okay, thanks.
Let's go on here to another caller. This is someone in Champaign County on line number two. Hello.
Hi, I'm glad you took on that point about administrative costs, because they are a large part of it. And as far as end-of-life costs, your point about preventive care is clearly related to that, because if preventive care is ongoing, then conditions aren't as likely to go into the kind of conditions that would cost as much. I mean, an old platitude, stitch in time, et cetera. But I wanted to thank you, gentlemen, for, I guess, coming out of retirement, sort of. I wonder if there's...
You're welcome. We didn't enter into retirement.
I wonder if there's...
We say we are emeritus, but we forgot to retire.
I see. I wonder if there's a nonagenarian from the Truman administration who could at least maybe provide a foreword or something to your book, because...
Well, as a matter of fact, my first professional job in the field was for President Truman's Commission on the Healthcare Needs of the Nation in 1952.
That was the first offer of universal health care. I'd like to for you to expand on that. Your story started with the Kennedy era, but actually, as you pointed out, goes to...
It started in 1914. 1915, when, interestingly enough, as we point out, the American Medical Association was supportive of universal health insurance. It was supported in 1928 Wagner, Murray, Dingell supported it during the Second World War. But the first time a president came out in support was Harry Truman. You're right.
Right. Your line about the two chambers and the room, the White House room and the two chambers of the Congress is good, but I think you should throw in, and you're clearly aware of it, the lobby.
Oh yes.
The lobby is the important part. That seems to be what torpedoed the kind of lame attempt at health care reform that came out of the Clinton administration. On that issue, late Senator Simon had a bill that was offered in the ferment of those times that would have allowed Illinois to reprogram its Medicare, Medicaid fund and everything and sort of try a statewide universal health care system. Obviously, it didn't go anywhere because the larger system didn't go anywhere, but that's actually sort of parallel to how Canada got universal health care for one province first. And there's something going on right now in Illinois with the Health Care Justice Act. They've had a first meeting. It's a state law, but it's meeting. They're calling for community meetings in every federal legislative district because they're aware that it has to be done also at the federal level. But this Health Care Justice Act is ongoing. There isn't a meeting in this district until February, but there's a series of community meetings going on with the goal of discussing it, how to do it and how to provide. And there's an admonition in the bill that the state legislature has to do something to provide universal access to health care by a date certain. So I don't know if you're aware of that. Quentin Young is probably the point person. And
right. Yes, we happen to know Quentin Young.
I presume that the circles aren't that wide.
A very important activist.
Right. I'm very preoccupied with this because I'm awaiting the denial of service appeal from HMO. So I spend a lot of time dealing with this paperwork and
right.
that sort of thing. So I guess there's a lot of fodder there, and I'll just hang up and listen and applaud.
Well, I would like to mention, to reinforce your point, that with the demise of the Clinton plan in the early 90s, the free market was really turned loose. The sorts of things you're struggling with getting authorization for whatever procedure it might be. And what subsequent years and the subsequent 12 years is what we have seen, essentially, the failure of the free market to really deal with all of these issues, especially inequities. But because of the dominance of the insurance industry and what we call the entrepreneurial revolution, when essentially the investment bankers took over medical care in this country, we have all of the complexities that you describe, and it's estimated that there are 3 million people employed by third-party payers whose main job is to try to get you from using services. So we've really been through a period when there's great dissatisfaction, and I think your point about statewide efforts, we have an analogous effort here in the state of Massachusetts now to get universal coverage. I think the importance of those efforts cannot be minimized, because if one looks at the history of Medicare, it is a history of 8 years of working at it, of having it defeated, of final passage. But final passage because there was organization out there, there was understanding, there was knowledge, there were senior citizen groups, and so on. So that I would be prepared to say that even if Massachusetts, having had a referendum on it, or Illinois, or Maine, or a number of other states that are trying, can't quite get there on their own, they will have created the organizational movement that would enable us to shift to a federal responsibility. Without education and without organization, the lobbyists do have free rein.
It's what we call generating the political will to get things done. And again, in 1965, we had it.
Let's talk again with another caller. This next person is in Indiana on line 3. Hello.
Hello. This will be anecdotal, but it's my aunt, so I know the facts are true. I guess the first two things that started bothering me about this whole situation is one, they had an NRP program where they listed the United States with all the industrialized countries in the world, not just the West, and gave, I don't, must have been 10 or 15 different sectors, you know, where we were. And my God, we were low on all of them. It just amazed me. And then the second thing that sort of dealt me a blow was when the Congress decided not to use a free market approach of competitive buying of drugs, that they disallowed that in the health bill coming through, and that amazed me. And my aunt gets $809 a month from Social Security, and of course she has Medicare. And at first I thought she was doing okay because she told me she received a Medicare drug card from an outfit in Florida and had $600 credit. Well, I found out that she only gets four pills, and I found out in 2 months the $600 was gone. And without some kind of help from family members, she either had to decide to pay her rent, eat food, or take her medicines. And somehow putting money ahead of people's lives, it just, you know, it splits me open. I get very disturbed about that, to the point where I have difficulty in arguing with people, because I really just want to get in their face and try to ask them what are their real values when they talk about the free market system. Thanks a lot.
Well, gentlemen, any comments you want to offer?
Well, I would say to that caller who began with an apology that this was only an anecdote. But it's, the world is made up of anecdotes. They are the important stuff. The data, the statistics are useful in the academic community. But I do believe that ultimately it's the anecdotes, which we shouldn't apologize for, that would influence the political system. My colleague Julie Richmond says that statistics are people with the tears wiped dry. And so I say to that caller, continue. I hope you won't have to continue to tell that particular anecdote, but it is the anecdotes that become the grist of political action.
Yeah, I would just add to your comment, your observation, really, in terms of the legislation, Medicare drug legislation. You see, that prohibited the purchase of drugs from Canada and bargaining. All of this has to be done through corporate entities that people sign up with. So you have the paradox that the people who are pro-free market, particularly dominating the Congress right now on these issues, are against the free market when it comes to bargaining to get lower prices, which the Canadians have.
Well, let's continue. We have someone here on a cell phone on our line four. Hello.
Thank you. I think your guests are quite informed, and it's a delight to see somebody that people have had so much experience in this area. What I'd like to make common is that this country is rapidly becoming very health in a health hazard area. For example, we have 50 million people with metabolic syndrome, 65 million people with hypertension, and half of them are not being treated, and the other half that are being treated are not being well controlled. And a disease, particularly with that has been a problem for over 50 years. Now, I know that the drugs are often a problem, but with hypertension specifically, which is, leads to lots of cardiovascular stroke problems, that if there are four different types of drugs that are in generics right now that could be used. But I don't really think it's because of the cost issue with this particular area, but I think it has to do with a lot of compliance, and as you're pointing out, is preventive medicine and educating the patient and so on. And I think there's a, and if you talk to a lot of physicians, they seem to agree that it's very difficult to get people to comply to take their medicines. Maybe we need to take some many different fold action here as far as putting some responsibility onto the patient, putting some responsibility onto the physician in healthcare to make sure that people are either dieting, exercising, or doing things that are moving in the right direction, either with a tax credit or whatever it would take to get people to, say, get serious about their health. And I'd be very interested in hearing what you think about just taking some novel approaches to, because evidently, you know, we've had diuretics out for close to 50 years, and we have we've got 30 million people that could probably do well on a diuretic in many situations that are not taking anything. And I'm very curious about what you have to say about that. Thank you.
Well, I think that's an interesting point that the caller raises, and perhaps both of you, but certainly Dr. Richmond might want to comment. It's one of those things you hear from physicians all the time, that people know what's good for them, and yet they don't do it. And if they did, even if they did a few simple things, lifestyle kind of things, they would be healthier, and ultimately we would spend less on healthcare.
Yes, and I think, you know, it's a very important point to make, because the great advances in the health of our people have really come from public health advances, you know, the sharp reduction in the acute infectious diseases of childhood and all of the immunizations that have helped prevent that. And yet what we have seen over time has been an erosion of our public health structure as well as our public health educational programs. And I think what the caller is really putting his finger on is the fact that we need to be more innovative in educating our population, starting, of course, since I'm a pediatrician to begin with children of school age and before, and certainly adult health education. And the gradual increase in the obesity of our population and its health consequences has been one example of this. Physicians alone, in their encounters with patients, won't be able to do all of this. They can be extremely influential, but we do need important public health educational campaigns. And because of the perceived crisis now with the rise in obesity in our population, we're finally beginning to pay more attention to this.
We're coming to the point where we almost have to stop. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I have to apologize because I have some callers here I don't think we're going to be able to take. But I do want to bring it back around to the point that we started with, the acknowledgement that we have a system where we are spending per capita a great deal of money on health care. We have a great deal of public dissatisfaction, and now many physicians also feel they're dissatisfied by the system. And everybody says, at least those groups say, something has to change. And in fact, people in government at the very least acknowledge that if we did nothing more but continue to cover the cost to the people that we're covering now, the elderly and some of the poor, the system we have now it's not sustainable because of the increase in cost. Something's got to happen. We have to deal with cost, rising costs, and we have to deal with quality of care, and we have to deal with the unserved. And we've got a number of huge problems here. What do we do, or at least what sort of initial steps could we take on the way to get to the place where we'd want to be?
I have a bias. I spent a major part of my life in the field of education. My colleague, Dr. Richmond, and I have written over the last years a number of editorials arguing that it's time for a debate to begin. It is not sufficient, it never has been, to wring one's hands and say something's got to change. And there are a number of proposals. I have colleagues who are enamored of the free market who think that that's the way to go. We think that what you'd have to do is begin a national debate about extending health insurance to everyone, to structure a discussion around many of the issues that were raised by the callers today about health behavior, about incentives, about bargaining, about preventive care. The system isn't going to cure itself. The disease will become more rampant.
And I would just add that, you know, we have some specific proposals about how to phase this in, and we particularly think that we ought to start, now that we have Medicare blanketing in the elderly population, start with all children. And
that has an additional advantage in that the costs of medical care for children are significantly lower than they are for the elderly, and so it's a good way, it seems to us, to move toward universality.
But you're, again, just to cap off, your idea is that the private sector would continue to provide the services.
Yes.
And that ultimately the government would pay the bill.
That's right. And but we think there needs to be a role for government in kind of calibrating for inequities in the system. For example, just financing the system wouldn't be enough. How do we get people, providers, into rural areas and all? And we have a proposal for how the government can play a broker's role in that.
Well, we are at the end of our time. We'll have to stop. And again, I should apologize. We have a couple of callers we can't take. I'm sure, though, it's a subject we'll come back to again in the future. For right now, though, we want to thank our guests, and Dr. Julius Richmond, Dr. Rashi Fine. Julius Richmond is a founder. He was the first director of Head Start, served as Surgeon General during the Carter administration. He is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Health Policy Emeritus at Harvard. Dr. Richmond, thank you.
Thank you.
And Rashi Fine is Professor of Medical Economics Emeritus at Harvard Med School. Dr. Fine, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So together, they are authors of the book you might want to look at. It's titled The Healthcare Mess, How We Got Into It and What It Will Take to Get Out. And that is published by the Harvard University Press. Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Also, support comes from Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with Julia Kelman. She holds appointments in the School of Art and Design and the College of Medicine at University of Illinois, and they'll be talking about what she calls expressive arts and the healing power of narrative. She says making art can help people find their way out of despair. They'll talk in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. In the next hour of this program, we will be talking about some about the life and work of the great American playwright Tennessee Williams and about his early work, Candles to the Sun. In fact, it was his first full-length play, was produced first in 1937, and is now being produced here on the U of I campus. And we'll talk with Christopher Bigsby from the University of East Anglia. He's British, but is an authority on American drama, and also Tom Mitchell, who's an associate professor of theater at the University of Illinois. First, though, we're going to take a break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets in the November soybean crop contract.